The coronavirus is hitting Wall Street hard, but the economic impact could be even worse on the local level. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The cruise industry, one of the bigger economic drivers in South Florida, is battling disastrous headlines. What more could the tourism industry from Palm Beach to Monroe counties expect? Also, it's spring and that means termites. But we shouldn't just be looking at protecting our homes. We're going to discuss why the pest control industry should also be targeting our trees. And it was 40 years ago when the race riots, known as the McDuffie riots, broke out in Miami.
It was almost like someone had gone along and struck a match and threw on something. Boom.
A new documentary film called When Liberty Burns will show during this year's Miami Film Festival. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you may have just heard, COVID-19 is officially a pandemic, this according to the World Health Organization. And according to the Florida Department of Health, there are 8 more confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state as of this morning, and as testing continues, many more are expected. Now, the impact of this coronavirus is being felt on Wall Street, with the Dow hitting its lowest point since the 2008 financial crisis on Monday. The economic impact may be even greater locally. March is a critical time for tourists in South Florida. Thousands travel here for spring break, music festivals like Ultra, and of course, the cruise ships. What's it going to mean for the tourism economy here? Joining me now is Rolando Aiedo, the Chief Operating Officer for the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau. He's joining me in studio. Rolando, thank you so much for the time.
Luis, thank you so much for having us, and especially in this issue and others.
I mean, the news just came down. Yeah. This is a pandemic. I mean, you hear that, and we're going to get into how this region, we don't have any confirmed cases here in Miami yet, again, as of this taping, but what do you think about when you hear that?
Well, you know, we are the most global destination, arguably, in the United States, based on the visitors that we receive from throughout the world. So, you know, this is a global situation. So needless to say, we are being impacted significantly. We've recently did a hotel survey, and 90% of the hotels have told us that their business has already been impacted. And by the way, that was about 2 days ago, and we're currently doing an update. But it has arrived, and it's our cruise lines are suffering. Our airlines obviously are making some adjustments, and our hotels and small businesses are being heavily impacted.
Are you saying cancel? You say impacted. What are you talking about, cancellations?
Yeah, we're seeing a combination of things, cancellations and postponements. So, for example, we just opened up our brand new Miami Beach Convention Center last year. 2020 was going to be a banner year. We had about 25 different major conventions. And when I say major, these are conventions that bring in thousands of people and go into multiple hotels and patronize lots and lots of small businesses. 4 of those have canceled and are looking at new dates. The other 20 are still on, but there's ongoing discussions in terms of possibly shifting some of those dates. So our hotels are seeing the impact, and most importantly, our hotel employees, because we've also been hearing about some adjustments on some hours and schedules.
What else are you hearing from people? I mean, you talk about the hotels, yeah. But what, you know, the other industries, small businesses, large businesses, the cruise industry, what are you hearing?
Well, as it stands right now, you know, airlines, just as an example, you know, we're looking out into the future to see what ticket sales are pacing. And I was at a meeting yesterday at the county commission on this issue, coronavirus, and the airport director, who's an amazing leader, you know, he's projecting probably about 10% downfall in business in the short term. That may not seem like a lot, and it's hard to gauge because the situation is so fluid. Conversely, Port Director Juan Carrillo, another amazing leader, he's been working hand in glove with the cruise lines. We are the cruise capital of the world. We are making a massive investment at Port Miami under his leadership. And they are a major employer in our community, so they are being impacted as well.
Look, I talked about at the beginning how March is, this time of year is so important, considering all the events and the visitors and so forth. But do you think you could put a number on just how big this month is, how big these next 2 months are for our economy?
Well, February and March, and especially March, to your point, is the peak of what people would call our tourist season. We do get tourists year-round, but in terms of the revenue that's generated, which is about $18 billion annually, a lot of that comes in through the February-March timeframe, because that's when the world wants to be here.
And that's Miami-Dade County.
And correct. That is Miami-Dade County, $18 billion. We get about 60 million visitors. They leave a lot of money in this community, lots of taxes, and I know we'll talk about that in a moment. But yes, good news is Super Bowl came and went in February, and I will tell you that's something that we had been working on for many, many years. So the revenue and that impact is going to help offset some of the decline in March.
Well, let's talk about one of those industries, the cruise industry, which it's getting a lot of really tough headlines, I would imagine, for the people in that industry. Then we hear from the State Department, them telling people, you know, telling travelers to avoid cruises. So, I mean, first of all, when you hear that, what's going through your mind?
Well, one of our goals is to educate our guests, our visitors, and our partners, and that needs to be a clear and consistent message. There has been some confusion, and as you know, the health department said one thing, then they retracted it partially. You know, cruising is one of those industries that the advice is for certain age groups and certain people with underlying conditions should reconsider. But we, you know, part of our goal is to maintain the business. We have to keep the industry going and to strike the right balance between risk management and not risk elimination, because there will be instances throughout our community, whether it's cruising, going to a restaurant, having a meeting or a convention, which is happening right now. We've got doctors at the Miami Beach Convention Center. And we as an industry and we as a Convention and Visitors Bureau are launching a series of initiatives to strike the right balance between educating, maintaining our business, and also launching a recovery program, because we've done this for 9/11, oil spill, Zika. We're the organization that takes the lead to bring back our industry.
This is a little tricky, though, because of the fact, kind of like Zika, but this is, we're talking about a virus. There is no vaccine.
Correct.
And there's still a lot we don't know about it, and it continues to spread. So, I mean, unlike a terrorist attack where there's a rebuilding, there's a healing and a rebuilding, mm-hmm. This is, as you said, it's fluid.
It is very fluid, and there's a lot of unknowns. But what we do know is that our industry is being heavily impacted. So we're already developing the plans and already deploying the plan. So for example, we're getting amazing interest from some people that want to come here to take advantage of the deals that are being offered. So hotels are making pricing adjustments, airlines are making pricing adjustments, and that's actually creating some incremental demand within certain sectors of the traveling public. And the drive market is an opportunity. So we're looking at where we can continue to responsibly fill hotel rooms, small businesses, and restaurants, because we need to keep this industry going.
I wanted to ask you about this today. I understand that Mayor Carlos Jimenez and some of the leaders of the cruise industry are in D.C., going to D.C. They are. What are they talking about? What's going on with that?
Well, again, I emphasize, as the cruise capital of the world, we are privileged that Washington is looking at Miami as a model of what we're doing. By the way, the port director is joining him on that trip. And it's really to exchange ideas and best practices. You know, we will get a full debriefing upon his return. But, you know, the plans that are being implemented by Port Miami and other ports, by the way, we're hoping will set the model for how ports throughout the country and arguably the world should deal with this issue. We don't currently, as we speak, I believe, have any cases in Miami-Dade County.
Right.
But I think that will be an eventuality. I think it's, you know, it's something that's going to impact us and especially some of our cruise ships. So I think those measures that I heard of yesterday at the county commission meeting are very encouraging in terms of the preparations that are being put into place.
Let me ask you about risk management and how you move forward. And I'm wondering what you're hearing from different industry leaders in South Florida, again, about how to manage that, the fear, the concern, and also the safety of your tourists, the safety of your customers. Yeah. Well, what are those conversations right now? And is there a blueprint for this?
Well, there's a blueprint with communicating to key stakeholders on the reality of the situation. And I referenced some of those other incidences, which do give us guidance. It is a very different situation, but we went through this. You know, Zika is perhaps the most recent, different situation, but it did involve some unknowns because that was unknown at the time as well.
Right.
One of our key stakeholders is the people that plan and bring meetings and conventions. Bear in mind, they're making a decision not just for themselves or their family, but literally for thousands of people. So they are the most risk averse because they're making decisions that that impact many, many people. So our sales team at the Convention and Visitors Bureau, immediately when this was breaking, was reaching out to them on a personal level, providing them with all the factual information, and we continue to feed it to them so that they can then disseminate it to those delegates to maintain as much business as we can as we get through this crisis.
The convention center is staying open, and as far as we know, I mean, a lot of conventions are still on, but, you know, what is that conversation you're having with any of those conventions if they start even showing signs that they may back out?
So, for example, and we were with the convention center on Monday with about 200 hotels at the convention center. One of the things that we're doing is going back to this education, educating the meeting planners, all the measures that the cities and the convention center are putting into place to mitigate, if not minimize, you know, additional sanitary procedures and protocols that are being put in place. In fact, you know, we've developed a lot of materials that we're distributing to hotels, flyers, common sense stuff that we're hearing about, but we want to make sure that all the hotels are increasing their degree of precaution. So with all that information, we are packaging it and telling the meeting planner, hey guys, we are collectively aware of this and we're taking this serious, and these are all the measures in place so that we can maintain as much business as possible.
I'm talking with Rolando Aedo, Chief Operating Officer for the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau. The organization is advising caution for tourists traveling to South Florida over fears of COVID-19, but again, trying to get the message out loud and clear, they are open for business. And again, as of the taping of this show, no reported cases yet in Miami-Dade County, but we do have more cases in the state of Florida that have been reported today. And that includes four in Broward, by the way. Ultra Music Festival, canceled. Gaia Ocho Festival, canceled. As of now, we know the Miami Open tennis tournament is still on later this month, though the tennis tournament in California that was on before this was canceled. What are the short and long-term impacts of losing an Ultra, of losing Gaia Ocho Festival?
Well, Ultra in particular is a vast user of hotel rooms, and it's generally considered one of the top revenue-producing events for our hotels along the lines of Art Basel, believe it or not. So it is a dramatic impact, and that's why, you know, we are working closely with our hotel community to help fill that void, to continue to bring business in a responsible way, but hotels have felt that directly. Gaia Ocho, approximately 1 million people. And 1 million people that not only are booking our hotels and small businesses, but they're experiencing some of our best culture that is then communicated throughout the globe. So yes, there is a significant impact with events of those scale. Like you, we've heard Miami Open is still on. We have a NASCAR event that's happening weeks from now, the Miami Youth Fair. So, you know, that is on as we speak, from what I understand. But
I wonder if you're having talks with them from time to time just to see where they're at and if they're going to continue.
Well, this was as recent as yesterday.
Okay.
And there was some discussion by the health department that events that are open air versus closed environments, there might be some distinction. And I think the county mayor is striking the right balance between discussions with these events. Ultimately, a lot of these decisions are being made by the event organizers with the advice or suggestion of city leaders. But those events like the Youth Fair, like NASCAR, like the Miami Open, those are a go. And again, I can't emphasize, yes, we are open for business.
Now, you have the message right now. Again, it's education. But what if, you know, we get a case or two that comes out of one of these events? Then is there a message for that? What's the messaging after that?
Well, the messaging, we anticipate that there will be cases. I think anybody, we've been blessed thus far, but I think cases will become prevalent throughout the country and in major metropolitan areas, and we happen to be one of those. The message doesn't change. The message is take common sense precautions. As we all know, this virus impacts, unfortunately, more seriously a certain demographic, a certain age group with certain conditions. And that's not a good thing. That's a terrible thing. And we're empathetic to that. But we're also empathetic to the hundreds of small businesses, the hotels that are supporting families through their jobs. So we want to strike the right balance between take common sense precautions, manage the risk, but also keep your doors open for business.
I know you've seen this in numerous communities. We're now seeing sporting events being canceled. And we've seen in some cases sporting events where they're being told you can't have gatherings in the thousands. So now you've got some hockey games, maybe some college basketball games that will be played in empty arenas. We have the Heat playing. The Marlins are about to start. We have a Major League Soccer team that's underway. The Panthers are playing. These things haven't reached that point yet, but you got to be thinking about that, and that's also a big drive.
Absolutely. Now, sporting events in general, unless you're talking about a championship game, tend to be primarily locals.
Right.
But we are very concerned with locals as well. In fact, some of our recovery programs include programs for locals. We want locals to vacation in their backyard more than ever. We want them to enjoy our amenities, to help compensate for some of that business. So we're launching a series of programs literally in the coming days for the balance of the spring and into the summer. You know, we're the organization that has value proposition programs like Miami Spice Restaurant Month, Miami Spa Month. We're moving up those programs to showcase these offers to people that will continue to travel within the state, within the city, and even from some feeder markets like Latin America and other places.
You mentioned it earlier, tax base. This is going to hit our tax base. Do we have an idea of what we felt so far, what we might feel? You know, any projections for the coming months?
Well, let me tell you where it typically is, right? So we, you know, those 60 million tourists, they generate $1.25 billion.
Again, for Miami-Dade.
For Miami-Dade County, just in sales taxes. So 38% of all the sales taxes that are collected in Miami-Dade County are paid by tourists. And by the way, that includes that 1% that goes towards our transportation system, as well as our public health trust through that local option penny. In addition to that, they pay about $250 million in tourist taxes, in a variety of tourist taxes, of which we get 11% for tourism marketing. The balance of that $250 million goes into a variety of projects that improve the quality of life for this community. It could be art centers, facilities, arenas, some of our parks. So I know there's always a discussion, do tourists pay their fair share? And I would emphatically say absolutely. And that does not even include the property taxes that hotels are paying, which in some communities can be as high as 42%.
Look, one of the challenges of this is, okay, we're talking about a health crisis and the impact it's going to have on communities around the world, as it already has. But the economy is also an important part of our lives. We need it. A lot of people, they have to have that paycheck. And yet we have to strike that balance. How do you do it? How do you say to people, come on down, have fun. It's a great place. But, you know, look, here's the reality. We've seen a couple of cruises already where we're telling the ship to have to sit out there and wait because there's a couple of cases that we found on that cruise ship, and now people have to sit on that and wait and see what happens. And I mean, and we have a lot of seniors that live down here, a lot of seniors. So where's the balance? How do we do this?
Well, as a, you know, there is precedence for this, and I alluded to some of this earlier, but you know, the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau, as the official tourism marketing for Miami-Dade County, you know, we have a huge responsibility to keep this community's number one industry viable through the good times and through the bad times. And one of the key roles that we've played, besides bringing tourists, besides bringing meetings and conventions, it's managing crisis and then leading a recovery effort. And that's why, you know, we're very concerned with what's happening besides coronavirus in Tallahassee, which has the potential of eliminating tourism marketing in Miami-Dade County. And I believe that was a topic that we were going to talk of as well. So we use the funds responsibly to come up with a responsible message. And that is something that we've done in the past through similar issues, and we will continue to do moving forward.
All right, so you're going to lead me into that. The Florida legislature is expected to be ending its session this week. There has been efforts to basically, you know, redirect tax dollars away from organizations like yours. Where is that at right now?
Well, as we speak, and we're here live on WLRN, there is another meeting happening in Tallahassee in the Senate Appropriations Committee. And they are looking at the current bill to hopefully remove any provisions that would divert tourism tax dollars to non-tourism promotion, especially in light of what's happening with coronavirus and the impact to our industry. There's been wide support from hotels and attractions and small businesses that would be a lethal mistake to make in this time more than ever.
All right, that is the tricky part because of it is this time. But again, this is an argument that's been made for a number of years now, you know, is the fact that they want to take away money from organizations like this because the argument is, this is Florida. It sells itself. Why do we need you?
Well, I guess the same reason Coke advertises and Nike advertises and Google, these are multi-billion dollar companies. And the reason they got their success is by continuously marketing and advertising themselves. And yes, everyone wants what Miami has. We have a very successful tourism economy, which, by the way, fuels real estate, trade, tech, Everything can be traced back to successful tourism in this community, and it's the foundation of an amazing economy. So we are competing not just within the state of Florida, within the U.S., but globally because of our success. So we have to continue to market. And I remind us, we are only using 11% collectively of all the tourist taxes that are paid annually in Miami-Dade County are being used for tourism marketing. The balance of that, the other 89%, is supporting a lot of the infrastructure and the resident quality of life projects. I don't think people know that. That does not include the $1.25 billion in sales taxes that they generate for our community.
And again, legislative session is about to come to an end, so we'll see where that goes. Again, talking with Rolando Aedo, Chief Operating Officer for the Greater Miami Convention Visitors Bureau. Rolando, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis, and thank you to your audience.
And, you know, we want to hear from you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. As a business owner, how are you feeling, you know, during this time? What's been happening, and what are your greatest concerns? Again, at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we're going to go back to 1980 in Miami and the Liberty City riots following the death of Arthur McDuffie. That's next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. 40 years ago this year, the 1980 McDuffie riots broke out in Miami.
People just exploded. It was almost like someone had gone along and struck a match and threw on something. Boom.
This happened months after Arthur McDuffie, a black insurance salesman and former Marine, ran a red light. He was chased by police and subsequently brutally beaten to death. The violence and rage unfolded after the Miami-Dade County police officers involved were found not guilty. Protesters argued the justice system failed, and one of the largest riots in Miami-Dade history began. Haitian-American filmmaker Dudley Alexis tells this story and history in his new feature documentary, When Liberty Burns, and he joins me now in studio. Mr. Alexis, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me here.
When did you first become aware of Arthur McDuffie, of his story?
Well, what happened back in 2015, a friend of mine was a taxi driver, and he was driving back home, hit a light pole, and by the time the police showed up, he got into an altercation with the police, and he died, and he was killed by the police. And I started doing research about Miami's relationship with my police relationship with the black citizen, and I came across the story of McDuffie, and I found out, like, how come I grew up here? I don't know anything about McDuffie. The more I started doing more and more and more research about it, and I said that the story need to be told, because none of my friend knew about it. Almost none of my friend knew about it. But when you ask somebody that's older, they stay quiet for a minute, or they start telling you how bad it was.
Did you ever start thinking about why you grew up here, why it wasn't discussed, why you didn't learn about it?
Yes. It turned out as a story Miami doesn't like to confront, and I don't think people in Miami like to talk about. Nobody like to talk about a bad moment in their life, and it was a bad moment in Miami's history, What I fear is because we afraid to talk about it, and it might happen again. So that's pretty much one of the reason why I wanted to tell the story.
Yeah. As you were researching, you know, tell me a little bit about some of the stuff that you found that, you know, surprised you about Arthur McDuffie. I want to talk a little bit about the man.
Well, who he was, how popular he was, and he was pretty much known by almost everybody in Liberty City. He was well liked, and because he was an insurance agent, he go from door to door, and people knew his name. People always, he become kind of after his death, is kind of become what's the word I'm looking for? An urban legend. Like,
yes.
So many stories about him. And the other thing that surprised me is how many people still doesn't want to talk about it. And some people will not even sit down and do an interview. They will just say, no, I don't want to talk about it.
Why did you want to tell this story?
You know, it's part of the history of Miami. I think people need to know. And I feel like Liberty City is a place that's always been ignored. And that story, I think I want people to start bringing attention back to Liberty City. And we drive to Liberty City all the time. We see Liberty City in the news, but nobody ever think about why stuff are like that in Liberty City. And I would like people to start thinking about that part of Miami again.
Going through the film again, your film is called When Liberty Burns. And the interesting part about this is not just the story of Arthur McDuffie and the riots that followed, when the officers were found not guilty, but you go through some of the history of racism in Miami, things like the ID rules for blacks, the creation of I-95, which forced historically black communities out of their homes, members of the KKK making up a big part of the City of Miami Police Department. Why was it important to hit on those points of history, as we're telling the story of Arthur McDuffie?
The thing I wanted to have people understand the relationship McDuffie had with the city. And he's somebody that grew up in Miami. I wanted to let people know what kind of neighborhood he grew up in, what kind of city he grew up in. And I wanted to put McDuffie within that place so people can understand the place and why everything built up and why everything happened in Liberty City. That's one of the main thing I wanted to show, the relationship of where he grew up and all of those were happening in Miami at the time. Some of the like you said, some of the history of Miami, why can explain why the black citizens of Miami were feeling like that, why they feel like that, was the last, that was the last straw, and why Miami exploded like that.
Everything that led up to.
Yes.
Because it was, I think, and I remember hearing, in the movie, basically it was almost like a bubbling up of all of this anger and tension. This moment was what allowed it to explode.
Yeah, it was happening for years. It didn't just happen.
Right.
Take
us back to December of 1979. Let's unfold the story.
Well, McDuffie was riding a motorcycle, heading back home, and popped a wheelie and ran a red light, and the police officers started chasing him. And he made a curve on 38th Street and off Miami Avenue and stopped his motorcycle. By that time, a bunch of officers one of the officers pulled him off the motorcycle and they all start beating him up. Within minutes, he lost consciousness and they called the paramedic and he died a few days later. So that's pretty much what that incident that led to his death and everything happened.
5 months after the death, the officers were acquitted of all charges. And it's important to note that the trial was moved out of Miami-Dade. It was in Hillsborough County.
Hillsborough County, yeah, in Tampa, which when the trial moved, the anger was already starting to build because people already felt at that moment. People felt that the police officers were gonna get away because they felt like they moved the trial pretty much so the officers can get away with murder.
And it was after the court decision. We get one of the largest riots in Miami-Dade history. Went on for 3 days. The National Guard had to step in. What do you think was the turning moment for this, though? Was it the fact that the trial was taken up to Hillsborough County, or the decision?
Well, the decision that, but it wasn't just the decision. So many things were happening at the that led to this for a police officer, a state trooper that molested a young girl, and he got away with it from Larry Shackley case, where he was shot and the police, you know, in the back of the head, and the and the police officer didn't even get charged. So all of those things were happening.
There was a lot of other incidents.
Yes, a lot of small incidents that led up to it.
I'm speaking with Haitian-American filmmaker Dudley Alexis. His new documentary, When Liberty Burns, takes us back to Miami's history of race relations, of racism, of police brutality. It focuses on the death of Arthur McDuffie, a black man who was chased by police and brutally beaten to death in the riots that came after the acquittal of the officers. You can see a trailer, by the way, of the film on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, so let's fast forward. This past February, WLRN reporter Nadesh Green went to a small Black History Month celebration honoring the life of Mr. McDuffie. There she talked to Arthur McDuffie, his son, Mark Patrick McDuffie, and he was only one when his dad was killed. Let's take a listen.
I'm a black man in America for the rest of my life. I still look at the news and I see black men like myself being mistreated, still being killed, still being beaten, and not seeing the right hand of justice.
Since these riots, what has changed within the Miami Police Department?
Well, one thing I can say, you know, the Progressive Officers Club did a lot of work. There were a group of black officers that really... before the riot, that were bringing a lot of cases forward to help community policing. There were a lot of improvement when you come to hiring minorities in the police force in Miami-Dade. There's a lot of those changes, and also since the riot, there's been a changes of demographic in Miami, and it's it's in many ways not the same Miami, and in many ways the same Miami, you know. So there's been a lot of change. It's been 40 years. So
go ahead. I thought it was interesting what you said earlier, that you talk to young people, and a lot of them may not know or remember much about, or they're not going to remember, but they're not going to know much about the history. But you talk to people who lived it, and they're either quiet or it gets very emotional. But what was it like trying to find those folks to want to open up and share their story with you?
Well, one of the hardest, I got to interview the family members, and it wasn't easy. Yeah, it took me a long time actually to get a chance to sit down with them, because they didn't want to open up. They didn't even want to talk to me, because they said a lot of time they do interview and nothing happened, and they always felt like nobody really tell the story of McDuffie the way that, you know, that way they're supposed to. So they didn't want to even open up to me. It took a while. It took what persistence.
What do you think was that the thing that finally got them to trust you and say, okay, let's talk?
One of the things I have to take my producer, Femi Falumi Brown. She actually the one that... she's older, and I said, they're not really opening up to me. And she said, Dudley, I got this. And she actually did it, and she actually brought them in. And I was, and I didn't want to do the documentary without them involved, because I didn't feel comfortable in telling a story of McDuffie and nobody in this, you know, that actually knew him, wasn't involved. So it took us actually almost a year to actually get the family to sit down with us.
There is one point in the film where it talks about this event being part of history and the effects that it's had on people who've lived through it. And here's a clip of Lonnie Lawrence. He's a childhood friend of McDuffie's and a retired police officer.
I think a lot of young people have no idea what McDuffie was. No idea. As a matter of fact, I don't think it. I know it. The older people, it has a lasting effect.
How did his family react to this idea that, you know, young people today, even you were one of them, you didn't know a whole lot about McDuffie?
You know, Miss Forestine, McDuffie's sister, she said one thing. She said, young people need to know. And she said, people have, you know, and she said she wanted to honor her brother's memory. And she wanted people to actually know the story. And she didn't feel comfortable that his brother's story was being forgotten in Miami, you know. And I'm so happy when they saw the documentary. They were okay with what they saw. And
yeah, how did they respond to it?
They responded really well to the documentary. Actually, they all saw the documentary. They were at the premiere, which made me feel really happy, really happy.
You know, February 2nd was proclaimed Arthur McDuffie Family Day by Miami-Dade County. Reparations to this family is something that has come up. Have any of the family members raised an argument about that, about reparations, considering what they've been through?
No. The thing is, they brought it to me the most is the fact they feel like Miami forgot the story. That's the thing. That's the one thing they brought the most is Miami forgot the story of, and they felt like the same thing can be repeated again, because they forgot the story, and they feel like it's something that can happen to anybody's family, and they will not want any family to go through this.
So people can see the film this weekend at the Miami Film Festival. Anywhere else they can watch it?
No, not yet. Please, show up. it's this Saturday at 12:30 at the Miami Film Festival.
Hopefully it will be available at some point for everybody to see it. One of those power, as you said, this is an important part of our history, and it cannot be forgotten.
Yes.
Again, been talking with Haitian filmmaker Dudley Alexis. His new documentary, When Liberty Burns, again, playing at the Miami Film Festival. You can see a trailer on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dudley, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come. It is termite season in South Florida. Is your home at risk? And are you thinking about protecting your trees as well? You should. It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, spring is just about here, and that means termite season has arrived in South Florida. Now, for homeowners out there, there are two species relatively new to the area that could cause some serious damage. Researchers have mapped their growth across the region, and they found urban tree canopy is also at risk. Thomas Chauvanc is the Assistant Professor of Urban Entomology at the University of Florida in Fort Lauderdale, and he joins us to discuss what you could do to protect your home and what we're doing to protect trees, especially in our parks. Thomas, always great to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Okay, so there are a number of different termites that we have to be watching out for, but for the month of March, what do we start seeing?
Well, we just passed most of the swarms from the native subs, Cyprian termites, so it's kind of a little behind, especially for South Florida. But the ones that are coming in the order is going to be the Asian Cyprian termites, which is now, basically the past week and the next few weeks. And then within a month, we're going to start having the West Indian dryweed termites and then the Formosan Cyprian termites.
All right. And again, let's remind what they look like. The Asian one, it looks like what?
So they all kind of look the same.
They all do look the same.
From a non-professional perspective. So this is the biggest problem that we actually have 21 species of termite in Florida, and there's going to be a lot of confusion when people, pest control, find them. They don't necessarily always know what it is and know what to do. So the first thing that needs to be done is when an insect that looks like a termite is found is to ID it, to basically identify it. And we provide this service at the University of Florida for free. We just want to know where these termites are. It's for us the best way to map them out as they spread throughout the area, because they are invasive species.
And what's the difference, though, between the Asian and the Formosan and the West Indian in terms of what they do?
So let's start with, I would say, the easy one. The West Indian dryweed termite has been in Florida for maybe 200 years, and it's literally in all old houses that has wood structure. They create this kind of coffee ground frass around windowsills. You're going to find some iridescent wings sometimes. They have the ability to live in a single piece of wood and make the whole colony with just 1,000 termites in there, and basically live without water, no contact to the ground. And it's going to be fairly easy to find because of that coffee ground of his wings showing up during the swarming season, which is about to be. So the solution for these guys is relatively easy. You can simply replace the piece of wood that is infested, or you can do a spot treatment. But the problem is usually if you have one infestation, chances you have multiple colonies throughout the house, including some areas where you cannot look at, including the attics. So this is why the fumigation industry is fairly important in South Florida, because we reset the house. We just kill every single colony and we're done, and you don't have to worry about it for the next 5-10 years when they're going to be back, because they're simply everywhere in South Florida. Then we have the two big invasive subterranean termites, and these are the ones that are a lot on my mind, because they do have a big impact on our community that is very different than the dryweed termites. The dryweed termites, they have a very slow metabolism. You have time to deal with it when you find them. It's like, I'll get to it. With subterranean termites, especially the Formosan or the Asian subterranean termite, when you find them, it's usually a little too late. That means there's already going to be a lot of damage. The reason is they have access to the ground. They grow up usually in trees. In terms of colony size, they can reach millions of individuals with just a few years. They have all the water you want. They have all the resources in the environment. And when they found your house, usually it's going to be as a mature colony. And it's going to be a million mouth to feed relatively quick. So they're both very similar. They're in the same genus. But one is subtropical, which is a Formosan, so it's going to be found from Miami to North Carolina. The Asian subterranean termite is what I like to call the tropical cousin, which is found from West Palm Beach all the way down to Brazil.
All right. We talk about protecting our homes, and it's important, and you know, everyone should advocate to protect their homes. But the other problem with this, too, is the damage to our trees, the damage to the tree canopy here in South Florida. Now we saw this, and we talked about this before, especially after Hurricane Irma. We saw trees that were damaged, and we thought, wait a second, these things have survived hurricanes. But we found that just because they had been eaten up from within and destroyed. What's that situation like right now? If I ask you, what does our canopy look like today? Is it safe?
Well, we're entering a new norm. And I don't think it's going to get better in terms of the health of the urban canopy. The Asian subterranean termite and the Formosan subterranean termite in trees and houses are actually the two sides of the same coin. Is the colony that is feeding on the tree next to your house is going to be the same colony, the same individuals within that million termite that is going to be feeding on the tree and on the house. So usually, by the time you realize you have them, the trees are already mostly eaten and the house has already excessive amount of damage. So this in mind, it is important to refocus some of our attention instead of just doing a remedial, coming and fix a house that has termite, is going to be prevention. And the prevention aspect that has been somewhat left aside is checking the trees. The reason is before they're going to get into your house for all the subterranean termites, they're going to be found mostly in trees. And if you can have a good eye for it and detect the activity of a termite when the colony is not too big yet, hasn't done too much damage to the tree, you can eliminate the colony, protect the tree, stop the damage, essentially save a tree, and prevent the damage in the structure at the same time.
They're going to start in the trees first.
They're going to be mostly in the environment and mostly in trees, yes.
I'm talking with Dr. Thomas Chauvanc, assistant professor at the University of Florida in Fort Lauderdale. Is your home at risk for termites? It is termite season, and that's what we're talking about, looking at the warning signs. But, you know, I want to talk about our urban canopy. We're going to talk about trees and talk about, you know, how to protect them. You know what? You were showing me a map. We talked about this before, too. You've been mapping where the different termite infestations are, because they can tell you what they're finding, and that's how you're mapping it.
Yes. So we basically get some samples from all around Florida from the pest control industry and also some concerned homeowners, which is a fantastic resource for us to figure out where these three invasive termite species are. And we created a Google Map layer that you can get on our website from at the University of Florida for the termite distribution. is you can actually narrow down to your own neighborhood to know what kind of termite has been detected over the past 25 years. And if you have a lot of red dots around your neighborhood, you know you have a lot of Asian superint termite that were detected right there. If it's a lot of yellow dots, it's going to be a lot of Formosan superint termite. So if you're in an area with absolutely no dots, it doesn't mean there's no termite, but that means that nobody ever reported it to us.
Right.
So it's even more important. If you find them, please send it to us. We'll tell you what they are, and it's a dot on the map
and
for
us. We'll share that, by the way, that website, so you could look at the map and you could see where, you know, where these are being reported. I want to ask you about this pilot study you're doing with the Fort Lauderdale Park and Recreation.
So because right now, the specifically with Asian superint termites, there are really taking a toll on our native urban tree canopy, which is a problem for the community as a whole. Of course, if a tree is on somebody's property, then it's the homeowner's issue that there's a colony in the tree next to the house. But we tend to forget the millions, maybe billions of trees that are on the public way. So we're talking about parks, about streets. All of these trees don't really belong to anyone, except they actually belong to the city. And some of the folks at the Fort Lauderdale Park and Recreation contacted me because they noticed something is happening. They noticed that some of the trees are dying, they're losing some of the old trees. And with a hurricane and with a lot of the diseases, including the termites, is just another actor within that tree canopy decline. So what we've been trying to look at is some of the parks that are really hit by some of these Asian superint termites, because they've been here for 20 years and nobody did anything to it because it was mostly not monitored or completely unknown, is we're trying to come up with a solution that we can basically protect these trees by stopping the damage at a whole area, where basically we're trying to eliminate all the colonies that are within that park and see if we can basically protect the trees and so we can enjoy the parks for decades to come.
What would be that solution, though? Is it about finding the trees and destroying those that are already infested?
Yeah, number one is detection. If there's no eyes out there to find them, you will never do anything. So what I do with one of my technicians, we go a lot into some of his public areas and to parks, and we look at trees, and there's going to be very interesting telltale signs that this is the Asian superint termite that is infesting that tree. The key signs for me is going to be the presence of mud tubes, and these mud tubes tend to be a different color than the bark of a tree, and they tend to follow the texture of a tree too. So visually, if you have a trained eye, you can detect them, and then you know that there's a solution if you know that this termite's actually in that tree.
Because one of the things in this, whether it's home or tree, is look, sometimes I've spotted those too, the little wings. Especially in the house, so I know, oh gosh, okay, termites.
It's time.
But when it comes to trees, though, what are a couple things that, you know, just the average person like me can learn to look for to say, wait a minute, there may be a problem with that tree.
So if you see something wrong with a tree, with a lot of something abnormal with the mud tubes, or sometimes what we call a carton nest, when you have a pruning wound from a tree that has been cut down years ago, eventually if you see this weird texture material that is dark brown or orangish that is filling the area, you know that it's potentially one of those invasive subterranean termites. So currently there's no DIY solution for curing these trees. You need to refer to a professional pest control that is licensed to provide a treatment. And currently the only treatment that we know can successfully eliminate a colony is going to be the use of above ground bait station that, again, are not available in for the general public. This is why you have to go through somebody who knows what it's doing. And by applying this bait station directly on the termite activity, they can feed on it, which is a tiny amount of chemical which only impact termite. This is one of the greenest technology on earth at this point to deal with any pest issues. And all they need to do is feed on it a little bit, bring it back to the whole colony, share it with all their nest mates, and within 2 to 3 months, the whole colony collapses.
if anything, just find you.
That's essentially what I suggest.
Just go to him. Dr. Thomas Chauvanc, assistant professor at the University of Florida in Fort Lauderdale. You can find more details in our videos with Thomas on our Facebook page at WLRN Sundial. Dr. Chauvanc, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, I think we're listening to some music from your band. You're in a band. All right, you are actually, right?
I am actually. I was there with Michael Stock just this weekend.
The Goodniks, that's what we're listening to.
Thank you.
All right, that is Sundial for this Wednesday, March 11th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to start WLRN's Spring Pledge Drive, bringing you some of our favorite conversations and still the important news. We're going to speak with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez about how the city is responding over the concerns of the spread of COVID-19. And we're going to revisit our conversation with the legendary astrologer, Walter Mercado. There's a new documentary celebrating his life. It's running in Miami this weekend. All of that coming up on the program tomorrow. Remember, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Also, you can go back and find past shows at WLRN.org or find us on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.